speed with which this occurs. As a general rule of thumb, you want to get the majority of your carbs from complex, slower-burning sources. How can we know which carbs are metabolized slowly and which are broken down quickly? We can use the glycemic index. How to use the glycemic index. The glycemic index, GI, is a numeric system that ranks how quickly the body converts carbohydrates into glucose. Carbs are ranked on a scale of 0 to 100, depending on how they affect blood sugar levels once eaten. A GI rating of 55 and under is considered low on the index, while a rating of 56 to 69 is medium, and a rating of 70 or above is high. Simple carbohydrates are converted into glucose quickly and thus have high GI ratings. Examples of simple carbohydrates and their corresponding GI ratings are sucrose, 65, white bread, 71, white rice, 89, and white potato, 82. Complex carbohydrates are converted into glucose more slowly and thus have lower GI ratings. Examples of complex carbohydrates and their corresponding GI ratings are apples, 39, black beans, 30, peanuts, 7, and whole grain pasta, 42. As I said earlier, you'll probably notice better all-around energy levels by getting the majority of your carbs from complex, lower GI foods. These foods are often more nutritious as well. You see, if you look at the GI ratings of various carbohydrates, you'll quickly notice that most nutritious, unprocessed sources of carbohydrate are naturally low on the GI. The majority of high GI foods are junk, like white bread, breakfast cereals, pretzels and chips, candy, soda, and so forth, that are quite low in nutrients and often filled with chemicals and other additives that are best avoided. If you got the majority of your carbs from these low-quality types of foods, your body composition may not be noticeably affected, but your health would be. You would likely develop micronutrient deficiencies over time and suffer from various nagging health issues. So, to repeat, my recommendation is simple. Get the majority of your daily carbohydrates from nutritious, unprocessed foods, which will incidentally be lower on the GI, but don't be afraid to include a few higher GI foods that you like. Now, as you can probably tell, I'm not anti-carb, which might strike you as a bit odd. It seems like every guru and his mother is jumping on the low-carb bandwagon these days, and everywhere you look, there's another book or news story about why low-carb is the way of the future. Well, I'm in the opposite camp. I'm going to recommend that you eat a healthy number of carbs every day, even when you want to maximize fat loss. And I have good data and reasons to back this up. If that sounds blasphemous to you, I understand. There's a lot of misinformation out there about carbs and how they affect the body. And it usually begins with the claim that the spike of insulin production makes us fat and ruins our health. This scientifically debunked myth is little more than the perversion of basic physiology to convince you of a boogeyman that doesn't exist. Insulin isn't the enemy. It's actually your friend. As you know, when you eat food, your pancreas releases insulin into the blood, and its job is to shuttle the nutrients from the food into cells for use. As this occurs, insulin levels gradually drop until finally all nutrients are out of the blood, and insulin levels then remain steady at a low baseline level, and the pancreas waits for us to eat food again and repeat the process. Generally speaking, carbohydrates cause a larger insulin spike than protein or dietary fat, which is why insulin haters say they're so harmful. Why is insulin so viciously attacked by mainstream diet gurus, though? It plays a vital physiological role in our bodies, a role that we simply couldn't live without. Why are we told that it makes us fat and sick? The answer relates to one of insulin's functions that influences fat storage. Specifically, it inhibits the metabolic breakdown of fat cells for energy and stimulates the creation of body fat. That is, insulin tells the body to stop burning its fat stores and instead absorb some of the fatty acids and glucose in the blood and turn them into more body fat. When explained like that, insulin becomes an easy target and scapegoat and shows why carbohydrates are often pilloried right next to it. The logic goes like this. High-carb diet equals high insulin levels, equals burn less fat and store more, equals get fatter and fatter. And then, as a corollary, low-carb diet equals low insulin levels, equals burn more fat and store less equals stay lean. At first glance, these statements sound plausible. Simple explanations are popular, and going low carb sounds like an easy way to get the bodies we desire without having to fuss over numbers. Well, while it's true that insulin causes fat cells to absorb fatty acids and glucose and thus expand, that physiological mechanism isn't what causes you to get fatter over time. Overeating does. Remember that the overriding factor in weight loss or gain is energy balance. No hormone can magically produce the surplus of energy required to fill up fat cells and make our waistlines grow. Only you can provide this by regularly feeding your body more energy than it burns. Another little fact that those with a phobia of carbs and insulin like to ignore is that the body doesn't need high levels of insulin to store dietary fat as body fat, thanks to an enzyme called acylation-stimulating protein. This is why you can't just eat as much dietary fat as you want and lose weight. And it's why research has shown that separating carbs and fats doesn't affect weight loss. Eating carbs and fats together or separately doesn't change anything. Now, chances are this is news to you and you're not sure what to think. Every month, some new article blows up all over the internet extolling the almost magical fat loss powers of low-carb dieting, usually referencing one study or another to back up its claims. It all seems very convincing. Well, there are about 20 studies that low-carb proponents bandy about as definitive proof of the superiority of low-carb dieting for weight loss. If you simply read the abstracts of some of these studies, low-carb dieting definitely seems more effective. Compared with a low-fat diet, a low-carbohydrate diet program had better participant retention and greater weight loss. During active weight loss, serum triglyceride levels decreased more and high-density lipoprotein cholesterol level increased more with the low-carbohydrate diet than with the low-fat diet. This study shows a clear benefit of a VLCK, very low-carbohydrate ketogenic, over LF, low-fat diet for short-term body weight and fat loss, especially in men. A preferential loss of fat in the trunk region with a VLCK diet is novel and potentially clinically significant but requires further validation. These data provide additional support for the concept of metabolic advantage with diets representing extremes in macronutrient distribution. Severely obese subjects with a high prevalence of diabetes or the metabolic syndrome lost more weight during 6 months on a carbohydrate-restricted diet than on a calorie- and fat-restricted diet, with a relative improvement in insulin sensitivity and triglyceride levels even after adjustment for the amount of weight lost. Well, this type of glib, abstract surfing is what many low-carbers base their theories and beliefs on, but there's a big problem with many of these studies, and it has to do with protein intake. The problem is the low-carb diets in these studies invariably contained more protein than the low-fat diets. Yes, one for one, without fail. What we're looking at in these studies is a high-protein, low-carbohydrate diet versus a low-protein, high-fat diet, and the former wins every time. But we can't ignore the high-protein part and say it's more effective because of the low-carb element. In fact, better designed and executed studies prove the opposite. That when protein intake is high, low-carb dieting offers no special weight loss benefits. But we'll get to that in a minute. Why is protein intake so important when restricting our calories for fat loss? You already know the answer, because it's vital for preserving lean mass, both with sedentary people and especially with athletes. If you don't eat enough protein when dieting to lose weight, you can lose quite a bit of muscle, and this in turn hampers your weight loss in several ways. One, it causes your basal metabolic rate to drop. Two, it reduces the number of calories you burn in your workouts. Three, it impairs the metabolism of glucose and lipids. As you can see, when you want to lose fat, your number one goal is to preserve lean mass, and eating an adequate amount of protein every day is vital to achieve this goal. Now, let's turn our attention back to the low-carb dieting is better studies mentioned earlier. In many cases, the low-fat groups were given less protein than even the recommended daily intake, RDI, of 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight, which is just woefully inadequate for weight loss purposes. Research has shown that even doubling or tripling those RDI levels of protein intake isn't enough to fully prevent the loss of lean mass while restricting calories for fat loss. So, What happens in terms of weight loss when you keep protein intake high and compare high and low levels of carbohydrate intake? Is there even any research available to show us? Yep. I know of 4 studies that meet these criteria, and gee whiz, look at that. When protein intake is high and matched among low-carb and high-carb dieters, there is no significant difference in weight loss. Here are snippets from each study. I recommend that you read the entire papers if you'd like to get the details or assess the overall quality of the research. KLC, ketogenic low-carbohydrate, and NLC, non-ketogenic low-carbohydrate diets were equally effective in reducing body weight and insulin resistance, but the KLC diet was associated with several adverse metabolic and emotional effects. The use of ketogenic diets for weight loss is not warranted. In case you're wondering, the NLC diet mentioned previously wasn't particularly low-carb. Subjects got 40% of their daily calories from carbohydrates. Reduced calorie diets result in clinically meaningful weight loss regardless of which macronutrients they emphasize. The objective of this research was to evaluate the effect of low-fat or low-carbohydrate diet counseling on weight loss, body composition, and changes in metabolic indexes in overweight postmenopausal breast cancer survivors. Weight loss averaged 6.1 plus or minus 4.8 kilograms at 24 weeks and was not significantly different by diet group. Loss of lean mass was also demonstrated. Weight loss was similar in LF, low fat, 100 plus or minus 4 to 96.1 plus or minus 4 kilograms, P less than 0.001, and LC, low carb, 95.4 plus or minus 4 to 89.7 plus or minus 4 kilograms, P less than 0.001 diets. So long as you maintain a proper calorie deficit and keep your protein intake high, you're going to maximize fat loss while preserving as much lean mass as possible. Going low carb as well won't help you lose more weight. Now, with all that out of the way, let's take a look at the benefits of eating adequate amounts of carbohydrate, starting with insulin's role in supporting muscle growth. You see, insulin doesn't directly induce protein synthesis like amino acids do, but it does have anti-catabolic properties. What that means is when insulin levels are elevated, the rate at which muscle proteins are broken down decreases. This, in turn, creates a more anabolic environment in which muscles can grow larger more quickly. That sounds good in theory, right? But does it pan out in clinical research? Yep. Several studies conclusively show that high-carbohydrate diets are superior to low-carbohydrate varieties for building muscle and strength. For example, researchers at Ball State University found that low-muscle glycogen levels, which are inevitable with low-carbohydrate dieting, impair post-workout cell signaling related to muscle growth. A study conducted by researchers at the University of North Carolina found that when combined with daily exercise, a low-carbohydrate diet increased resting cortisol levels and decreased free testosterone levels. Cortisol, by the way, is a hormone that breaks tissues, including muscle, down. In terms of maximizing muscle growth, you want low resting cortisol levels and high free testosterone levels. These studies help explain the findings of a study conducted by researchers at the University of Rhode Island that looked at how low and high carbohydrate intakes affected exercise-induced muscle damage, strength recovery, and whole-body protein metabolism after a strenuous workout. The results showed the subjects on the low-carbohydrate diet, which wasn't all that low, about 226 grams per day versus 353 grams per day for the high-carbohydrate group, lost more strength, recovered more slowly, and showed lower levels of protein synthesis. Similar results were demonstrated by a study conducted by researchers at McMaster University, which compared high and low carbohydrate dieting with subjects performing daily leg workouts. They found that those on the low carbohydrate diet experienced higher rates of protein breakdown and lower rates of protein synthesis, resulting in less overall muscle growth than their higher carbohydrate counterparts. So for all of these reasons, bigger, leaner, stronger doesn't involve any form of low-carb dieting. Instead, you'll eat quite a few grams of delicious carbohydrates per day, and that's going to help you get big, lean, and strong. Dietary fat. Dietary fat is the densest energy source available to your body, with each gram of fat containing more than twice the calories of a gram of carbohydrate or protein, 9 versus 4, respectively. Healthy fats, such as those found in meat, dairy, olive oil, avocados, and various seeds and nuts, help your body absorb the other nutrients that you give it, nourish the nervous system, maintain cell structures, regulate hormone levels, and more. Chemically speaking, dietary fat is composed of chains of carbon atoms that can be anywhere from 2 to 22 atoms in length. Most of the dietary fat found in the American diet is of the long chain variety, with 13 to 21 carbons per molecule. If the carbon atoms are bound together in a certain way, the result is the unsaturated form of fat, which is liquid at room temperature and found in high amounts in foods like fish, oils, and nuts. If there are no such bonds between the carbon atoms, the result is the saturated form of fat that is solid at room temperature and found in high amounts in dairy products. While meats are generally thought of as rich in saturated fat, and red meat in particular, they contain about as much unsaturated fat as saturated. It's also commonly believed that eating saturated fat increases your risk of heart disease. However, a panel of scientists from the University of Cambridge and Medical Research Council, University of Oxford, Imperial College London, University of Bristol, Erasmus University Medical Center, and Harvard School of Public Health recently analyzed 72 studies in more than 1 million subjects and showed this to be untrue. While we now know that saturated fat isn't the danger we once thought it was, we don't quite know what the optimal daily intake should be either. The most recent report of dietary guidelines published by the USDA, 2010, maintains the 2002 recommendation that we get less than 10% of our daily calories from saturated fat. But researchers point out that this recommendation is based on flawed research linking saturated fat intake with heart disease, so there's a good chance this restriction will be modified in future guidelines. Until then, I recommend that you loosely follow the USDA's recommendation. The type of fat that you want to avoid at all costs is trans fat. In case you don't remember, trans fat is a form of unsaturated fat not commonly found in nature. Trans fat is created artificially and added to food primarily to increase shelf life, and it's bad news. Research has associated trans fat intake with a variety of health problems. Heart disease, insulin resistance, systemic inflammation, female infertility, diabetes, and more. There's a reason why the Institute of Medicine recommends that our trans fat intake be as low as possible. Many cheap packaged foods contain trans fat, such as microwavable popcorn, yogurt, and peanut butter. So do frozen foods such as pizza, packaged pastries, cakes, and the like. And fried foods are often cooked in trans fat. Any food that contains hydrogenated oil or partially hydrogenated oil contains trans fats. Unfortunately, avoiding trans fats isn't as simple as finding foods with labels claiming them to be trans fat free. To meet the FDA's definition of 0 grams trans fat per serving, food doesn't have to contain no trans fats. It must simply contain less than 1 gram per tablespoon, or up to 7% by weight, or less than 0.5 grams per serving. So if a bag of cookies contains 0.49 grams of trans fat per serving, the manufacturer can claim it's trans fat free on the packaging. The best way to avoid trans fats is to shun the types of foods that commonly contain them, regardless of what the nutrition facts panel says. So to recap, you can be quite flexible in how you get your dietary fats. Dairy, meat, eggs, oils, nuts, and fish are all healthy sources. You don't have to fret over your saturated fat intake, but you should strive to get plenty of unsaturated fats in your diet as well, and should eat as little trans fat as possible. I eat absolutely none. Water. The human body is about 60% water in adult males and about 70% in adult females. Muscles themselves are about 70% water. That alone tells you how important staying hydrated is to maintaining optimal levels of health and body function, your body's ability to digest, transport, and absorb nutrients from food depends upon proper fluid intake, and staying hydrated helps prevent injuries in the gym by cushioning joints and other soft tissue areas. As you can see, when your body is dehydrated, just about every physiological process is negatively affected. To avoid dehydration, the Institute of Medicine reported in 2004 that women should consume about 91 ounces of water, or 3/4 gallon, per day, and men should consume about 125 ounces per day. A gallon is 128 ounces. Now, keep in mind that those numbers include the water found in food, which accounts for about 20% of the water in the average person's diet. I've been drinking 1 to 2 gallons of water per day for years now, which is more than the Institute of Medicine's baseline recommendation, but I sweat a fair amount when I exercise, and I live in Florida, which means even more fluid loss through sweating. Make sure the water you drink every day is filtered and not straight from the tap. While some people assume that tap water is clean enough to drink regularly, research has shown that it is becoming more and more contaminated with all kinds of pollutants, including bacteria, pharmaceuticals, heavy metals, and various types of poisonous chemicals. Many people are already aware of this and stick to bottled water, but this isn't a great solution. Not only is it expensive, but research has also shown that bottled water is chock full of chemicals. One study examined 18 different bottled waters from 13 different companies and found more than 24,000 chemicals present, including endocrine disruptors. Martin Wagner, a scientist at Goethe University, Frankfurt's Department of Aquatic Ecotoxicology, had this to say. Bottled water had a higher contamination of chemicals than glass bottles. There are many compounds in bottled water that we don't want to have there. Part is leaching from the plastic bottles, lids, or contamination of the well. This is why I recommend investing in an effective water filtration device and why I stick to filtered water myself. What you want to achieve with water filtration is low levels of dissolved solids in the water, as measured by an inexpensive testing device that gives a parts per million reading. The closer to zero, the better. Tap water generally tests at anywhere from 200 to 700 parts per million of dissolved solids. You can find a link to the testing device I use in the kitchen recommendations of the bonus report at the end of the book, along with my preferred filtration products. Vitamins and minerals. Many people aren't aware of the physiological role and importance of vitamins and minerals. Guys will rush to their local supplement stores to buy the latest super advanced muscle maximizing pills and powders containing proprietary blends of fancy sounding junk ingredients, but few of them will invest money in healthier foods or a multivitamin. Well, the fact is that your body needs a wide variety of vitamins and minerals to perform the millions of physiological processes that keep you alive and well. This is a basic building block of optimal health and performance. Just like protein, carbohydrates, fats, and water, neglecting the nutritional aspect of dieting will, in time, severely compromise both your overall health and your performance capacity. Ideally, we'd get all of the vitamins and minerals we need from the food we eat, but this is easier said than done. First, there's the issue of the ever-declining quality of soil and food, even in the world of organic, which makes it harder to get adequate nutrition from our diets. And then there's the fact that maintaining optimal levels of vitamin and mineral intake requires a bit of planned dietary diversity, which can be done but can also be time-consuming. Personally, I prefer a simpler approach. I make sure the majority of my calories come from nutrient-dense foods, such as the following: avocados, greens, chard, collard greens, kale, mustard greens, and spinach, bell peppers, Brussels sprouts, mushrooms, baked potatoes, sweet potatoes, berries, low-fat yogurt, eggs, seeds, flax, pumpkin, sesame, and sunflower, beans, garbanzo, kidney, navy, and pinto, lentils and peas, almonds, cashews, and peanuts, whole grains such as barley, oats, quinoa, and brown rice, salmon, halibut, cod, scallops, shrimp, and tuna, lean beef, lamb, and venison, and chicken and turkey. I also supplement with a good multivitamin to fill any holes left by my diet and ensure my body gets all the micronutrients it needs. Eating plenty of nutritious foods and supplementing with a good multivitamin takes care of all of your micronutrient needs, but I want to take a minute to discuss two minerals in particular that usually need some special attention in most people's diets: sodium and potassium. Balancing your sodium and potassium levels. The Institute of Medicine recommends 1,500 milligrams of sodium per day as the adequate intake level for most adults and an upper limit of 2,300 milligrams per day. Most people eat a lot more than this, however. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the average American over age 2 eats 3,436 milligrams of sodium per day. Chronic high sodium intake not only promotes excessive water retention, making you look fatter, but it can also raise blood pressure and increase the risk of heart disease. Overconsumption of sodium is surprisingly easy, too. A teaspoon of table salt contains a whopping 2,300 milligrams of sodium. Yup, you heard that right. One teaspoon of table salt per day provides you with the recommended upper limit of sodium. Thus, I recommend that you keep an eye on your sodium intake and keep it around the Institute of Medicine's adequate intake level. I do this by just salting one meal per day, dinner. You also want to ensure your body gets enough potassium as well, as it helps balance fluid levels in the cells. Sodium sucks water in, and potassium pumps it out. According to the Institute of Medicine, we should consume sodium and potassium at about a 1-to-2 ratio, with 4,700 milligrams per day as the adequate intake of potassium for adults. There are many natural sources of potassium, such as all meats and fish, vegetables like broccoli, peas, tomatoes, sweet potatoes, and beans, fruits like bananas, dried apricots, avocado, and kiwi, dairy products, and nuts. You can also buy potassium tablets that you can supplement with if necessary. Fiber. Fiber comes in two forms, soluble and insoluble. Soluble fiber dissolves in water and tends to slow the movement of food through the digestive system. Research has shown that soluble fiber is metabolized by bacteria in the colon, and hence it has little effect on stool weight. However, it can increase fecal output by stimulating the growth of healthy bacteria and fatty acids, and it is an important source of fuel for the colon. Common sources of soluble fiber are beans and peas, oats, certain fruits like plums, bananas, and apples, certain vegetables like broccoli, sweet potatoes, and carrots, and certain nuts, with almonds being the highest in dietary fiber. Unlike soluble fiber, insoluble fiber doesn't dissolve in water and does contribute to stool weight. It bangs against the walls of the intestines, causing damage, but research has shown that this damage and the resulting repair and cellular regeneration are healthy processes. Common sources of insoluble fiber are whole grain foods like brown rice, barley, and wheat bran, beans, certain vegetables like peas, green beans, and cauliflower, avocado, and the skins of some fruits like plums, grapes, kiwis, and tomatoes. The importance of getting adequate fiber has been known for a long time. The ancient Greek physician Hippocrates, who famously said, "Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food," recommended whole grain breads to improve bowel movements. Ensuring our fiber intake is adequate is much more important than just taking good poops, though. Fiber intake and cancer. A study conducted by researchers at the Institute of Social and Preventive Medicine in Switzerland found that the fiber in whole grains was associated with a reduced risk of mouth and throat cancer. Refined grains had no such association because the fiber is removed during processing. According to research conducted by scientists at Imperial College, getting adequate fiber every day may also reduce the risk of breast cancer. Fiber intake and heart disease. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States. This type of disease is caused by a buildup of cholesterol in the blood vessels that feed the heart, arteries, which makes them hard and narrow. This is known as arteriosclerosis, and a total blockage of an artery produces a heart attack. A pooled analysis conducted by researchers at the University of Minnesota analyzed the data from 10 studies to investigate the association between fiber intake and heart disease. Researchers found that each 10-gram increase in daily fiber intake was associated with a 14% decrease in risk of all heart disease and a 27% decrease in risk of death from such disease. Research conducted by scientists from Harvard University supports these findings. After following 43,757 men for 6 years, these researchers found that as fiber intake increased, the risk of heart disease decreased. Further research from Harvard University demonstrated that soluble fiber decreases total and LDL bad cholesterol levels, which helps protect against heart disease. Fiber intake and metabolic syndrome. Metabolic syndrome is a combination of disorders, including high blood pressure, high insulin levels, obesity with excessive weight in the abdomen area, high levels of triglycerides, particles in the body that carry fats, and low HDL, good cholesterol levels. Among its many obvious dangers, metabolic syndrome markedly increases the risk of heart disease and diabetes. Research conducted by scientists at Tufts University demonstrated that increasing whole grain intake reduced the risk of developing this syndrome. It was found that the fiber and magnesium in the whole grains were primarily, but not wholly, responsible for these benefits. Fiber's ability to help preserve metabolic health isn't surprising, as studies have shown that it improves blood sugar control, reduces blood pressure, decreases cholesterol levels, and can prevent weight gain and promote weight loss. Fiber intake in type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is characterized by chronically high blood sugar levels and is caused by an inability to produce enough insulin to lower blood sugar levels, or by cells being unable to use insulin properly. Studies have shown that fiber reduces the risk of developing type 2 diabetes because it improves your body's ability to use insulin and regulate blood sugar levels. On the other hand, a diet low in fiber and high in simple carbohydrates has been shown to increase the risk of developing type 2 diabetes and heart disease. Fiber intake and diverticulitis. Diverticulitis is an intestinal inflammation and is one of the most common colon disorders in the Western world. It's quite painful and especially prevalent in those over 45 years of age. Researchers at Harvard University conducted a study that followed 43,881 men, and they found that eating adequate fiber, insoluble fiber in particular, was associated with a 40% reduction in the risk of diverticulitis. How much fiber do you need every day? The evidence is pretty clear. Eat enough fiber and you're more likely to live a long, healthy life. According to the Institute of Medicine, children and adults should consume 14 grams of fiber for every 1,000 calories of food eaten. Here are some easy ways to make sure you hit your daily requirement. Eat whole fruits instead of drinking juices. Choose whole grain breads, rice, cereals, and pasta over processed forms. Eat raw vegetables as snacks instead of chips, crackers, or energy bars. Include legumes in your diet. A tasty way to do this is to cook some international dishes that use a lot of whole grains and legumes, such as Indian or Middle Eastern food. If you'd like to see the fiber content of a wide variety of common foods, Harvard University created a handy chart that you can find here. http://bit.ly/hvd-fiber. Subtracting fiber from your daily carbohydrate intake. Chances are you've heard that fiber is calorie-free and thus can be subtracted from your total daily carbohydrate intake to free up room for more yummy carbs. Unfortunately, it's not that simple. Only insoluble fiber can't be processed by your body and goes right through you. Soluble fiber turns into a fatty acid in the gut and contains somewhere between 2 and 4 calories per gram. Scientists aren't sure yet. If you wanted to, you could sit down and work out how many grams of insoluble fiber you're eating every day and subtract that number from your daily carbohydrate intake. But in my opinion, it's not worth the trouble to find out that you can take a few extra bites of food every day. This is also a good place to quickly address the concept of net or active or impact carbs, as these terms are commonly used marketing ploys to convince people they can eat all kinds of foods without having them count. For example, a protein bar might proclaim only 4 grams of net carbs, but when you check the nutrition facts panel, it lists 25 grams of carbohydrate and all the calories. What's up with that? Well, the problem is that there is no legal definition for these marketing terms, and the FDA doesn't evaluate any claims using them. What most manufacturers do is take the total number of carbohydrates a product contains and subtract fiber and sugar alcohols and list that number as the net active or impact number. This is misleading because most sugar alcohols contain calories, although less than the standard 4 calories per gram found in other forms of sugar. And as you now know, every gram of soluble fiber contains calories as well that can't be subtracted. You can eat these foods if you'd like, but just count all the carbs and calories listed on the Nutrition Facts panel and ignore the marketing buzzwords. The bottom line. You may find this chapter a bit hard to swallow, no pun intended. Some people have a hard time changing their eating habits, but the benefits of following my dietary advice far outweigh the negatives. 1. If this is a completely new way of eating for you, I guarantee you'll feel better than you have in a long time. You won't have energy highs and lows or feel lethargic or mentally foggy from micronutrient deficiencies or the overconsumption of simple sugars. 2. The types of proteins, carbs, and fats that you eat can have a significant impact on how you look. Eat poorly, and you can easily wind up bloated and puffy. Eat well, and you can look noticeably leaner. 3. You'll enjoy bad food so much more when you eat less of it. Pizza tastes so much better when you haven't had it in a week. 4. On the flip side, the more you eat nutritious foods, the more you'll come to enjoy them, I promise. Even if they don't taste too good to you at first, just groove in the routine and soon you'll look forward to your whole grains and fruit instead of donuts and candy. Chapter summary. Introduction. The nutritional aspect of fitness is incredibly powerful and it either works for or against you, multiplying or dividing your results. Proper nutrition boils down to supplying your body with the nutrients needed to efficiently recover from your workouts and manipulating energy intake to lose, maintain, or gain weight as desired. Regardless of the sources food-wise, 1 gram of protein contains 4 calories, 1 gram of carbohydrates contains 4 calories as well, and 1 gram of fat contains 9 calories. Many factors determine the total amount of energy that your body burns every day, such as body size, total lean mass, body temperature, the thermic effect of foods, the amount of energy it costs to process food for use and storage, stimulants such as caffeine, and the level of physical activity. Protein. A high-protein diet is absolutely vital for building muscle and preserving it when you're dieting for fat loss. Regular exercise, and weightlifting in particular, increases your body's need for essential amino acids and thus protein. Your best choices are meat, dairy products, and eggs, and second to those are certain plant sources like legumes, nuts, and high-protein vegetables like peas, broccoli, and spinach. Protein from meat is particularly helpful when you're weightlifting, as research has demonstrated that eating meat increases testosterone levels and is more effective for building muscle than vegetarian sources. If you're vegetarian, while it's true that you would do better if you ate meat, don't despair. You can still do well on the program so long as you eat enough protein every day and stick to high-quality sources. It's hard to put an accurate cap on how much protein your body can absorb in one meal. It's definitely a hell of a lot more than the 20 to 30 grams that some people claim. Eating protein more frequently is likely superior to less frequently. Each protein feeding should contain at least 30 to 40 grams of protein, and feedings can contain quite a bit more protein if necessary to hit daily targets. Whey protein can be taken anytime, but it's particularly effective as a post-workout source of protein because it's rapidly digested, which causes a dramatic spike in amino acids in the blood, especially in leucine. Carbohydrate. Carbohydrates, in all forms, aren't stored as body fat as efficiently as dietary fats are. Carbohydrates play an essential role in not only muscle growth, but also in overall body function. Monosaccharides are often called simple carbohydrates because they have a simple structure. Oligosaccharides are molecules that contain several monosaccharides linked together in chain-like structures. Polysaccharides are long chains of monosaccharides, usually containing 10 or more monosaccharide units. All forms of carbohydrate we eat are either metabolized into glucose or are left indigested, serving as dietary fiber. High long-term intake of simple carbohydrates, disaccharides like sucrose and HFCS, has been associated with an increased risk of heart disease and type 2 diabetes. Overweight, sedentary bodies don't deal with simple sugars nearly as well as lean, physically active ones do. If you exercise regularly and aren't overweight, your body can likely deal with simple carbohydrates just fine. Eating a lot of foods with added sugars can reduce the amount of micronutrients your body gets and thus cause deficiencies. The glycemic index, GI, is a numeric system of ranking how quickly carbohydrates are converted into glucose in the body, A GI rating of 55 and under is considered low GI, 56 to 69 is medium, and 70 and above is high on the index. Get the majority of your daily carbohydrates from nutritious, unprocessed foods, which will incidentally be lower on the GI, but don't be afraid to include a few higher GI foods that you like. Insulin tells the body to stop burning its fat stores and instead absorb some of the fatty acids and glucose in the blood and turn them into more body fat. But that's not what causes you to get fatter over time. Overeating does. When protein intake is high and matched among low-carb and high-carb dieters, there is no significant difference in weight loss. When insulin levels are elevated, the rate at which muscle proteins are broken down decreases. This, in turn, creates a more anabolic environment in which muscles can grow larger more quickly. Dietary fat. Dietary fat is the densest energy source available to your body, with each gram of fat containing over twice the calories of a gram of carbohydrate or protein. Healthy fats, such as those found in meat, dairy, olive oil, avocados, and various seeds and nuts, help your body absorb the other nutrients that you give it, nourish the nervous system, help maintain cell structures, regulate hormone levels, and more. While we now know that saturated fat isn't the danger we once thought it was, we don't quite know what the optimal daily intake should be either. The most recent report of dietary guidelines published by the USDA 2010 maintains the 2002 recommendation that we get less than 10% of our daily calories from saturated fat. Research has associated trans fat intake with a variety of health problems: heart disease, insulin resistance, systemic inflammation, female infertility, diabetes, and more. The best way to avoid trans fats is to shun the types of foods that commonly contain them, regardless of what the nutrition facts panel says. Water. When your body is dehydrated, just about every physiological process is negatively affected. The Institute of Medicine reported in 2004 that women should consume about 91 ounces of water, or 3/4 of a gallon, per day, and men should consume about 125 ounces per day. A gallon is 128 ounces. Make sure the water you drink every day is filtered and not straight from the tap. Vitamins and minerals. Your body needs a wide variety of vitamins and minerals to perform the millions of physiological processes that keep you alive and well. Ideally, we'd get all of the vitamins and minerals we need from the food we eat, but this is easier said than done. Get the majority of your calories from nutrient-dense foods. The Institute of Medicine recommends 1,500 milligrams of sodium per day as the adequate intake level for most adults and an upper limit of 2,300 milligrams per day. A teaspoon of table salt contains a whopping 2,300 milligrams of sodium. According to the Institute of Medicine, we should be consuming sodium and potassium at about a 1 to 2 ratio, with 4,700 milligrams per day as the adequate intake of potassium for adults. Fiber. The evidence is pretty clear. Eat enough fiber and you're more likely to live a long, healthy life. According to the Institute of Medicine, children and adults should consume 14 grams of fiber for every 1,000 calories of food eaten. Only insoluble fiber can't be processed by your body and goes right through you. Soluble fiber turns into a fatty acid in the gut and contains somewhere between 2 to 4 calories per gram. Play it safe with food products that promote net, active, or impact carbs, and just count all the carbs listed on the Nutrition Facts panel. Chapter 13. How to maximize your gains with pre- and post-workout nutrition. Most champions are built by punch-the-clock workouts rather than extraordinary efforts. Dan John. As you know, when you eat generally doesn't matter. So long as you hit your daily numbers, you can lose fat and build muscle with ease. That said, there are two meals that do matter: pre- and post-workout meals. The pre-workout meal. Like most aspects of bodybuilding, the subject of pre-workout nutrition is riddled with contradictions. Does pre-workout nutrition even matter? Should you eat protein before you train? Carbohydrates? Fats? If so, what types and amounts of food are best? Or will eating before training have no appreciable effect on your performance or results? Well, let's get to the bottom of these questions and come to some definitive science-based conclusions as to what's what with pre-workout nutrition. Pre-workout protein. Some people say eating protein before you work out doesn't matter, and they'll often cite a study or two to back up their claims. On the other hand, you can find scientific evidence that pre-workout protein does enhance post-workout muscle growth. What gives? Well, a big invisible piece of this puzzle has to do with when study subjects had last eaten protein before eating their pre-workout meals. You see, when you eat food, it takes your body several hours to fully absorb the nutrients contained within. The larger the meal, the longer it takes. Research shows that absorption can take anywhere from 2 to 6 or more hours. This means that if you had eaten a sizable amount of protein an hour or two prior to working out, your plasma, blood, amino acid levels would be quite high come workout time, and protein synthesis rates would be maximally elevated. In this case, it's unlikely that more protein before training would make much of a difference in terms of helping you build more muscle because your body is already in an anabolic state. On the other hand, if it had been several hours since you last ate protein, and especially if the amount you ate was small, less than 20 grams, your plasma amino acid levels would likely be low come workout time, and protein synthesis rates would be lower than they could be. In this case, research shows that pre-workout protein likely will help you build more muscle because it spikes plasma amino acid levels, and thus protein synthesis rates before training. Most people train early in the morning or several hours after lunch, after work, or before dinner, and this is why I generally recommend 30 to 40 grams of protein about 30 minutes before training. If, however, you train within 1 to 2 hours of eating at least that much protein, you can probably skip the pre-workout protein and not miss out on any extra potential muscle growth. Regarding the best types of pre-workout protein, we know that the faster a protein is digested and the more leucine it has, the more short-term muscle growth it stimulates. And while any form of pre-workout protein will elevate plasma amino acid levels, you'll get the quickest and greatest elevation from a faster digesting form like whey protein, which is also high in leucine. Pre-workout carbohydrate. Fortunately for us, the research on eating carbohydrates before a workout is much more straightforward. It improves performance, period. Specifically, eating carbohydrates 15 to 30 minutes before exercise will provide your muscles with additional fuel for your workouts, but it will not directly stimulate additional muscle growth. I say directly stimulate because while eating carbohydrates before a workout doesn't affect protein synthesis rates, it can help you push more weight and reps in your workouts, thus indirectly helping you build more muscle over time. So, if eating pre-workout carbs is good, what types are best? Again, the research is pretty straightforward. Low-glycemic carbohydrates are best for prolonged, 2 or more hours, endurance exercise, and high-glycemic carbohydrates are best for shorter, more intense workouts. In terms of what to eat, I don't like pre-workout carbohydrate supplements. They're little more than overhyped, overpriced tubs of simple sugars like dextrose and maltodextrin. Don't buy into the marketing BS. There's nothing inherently special about these types of molecules other than that they're easy to digest. Instead, I much prefer getting my pre-workout carbohydrates from food. My favorite sources are rice milk, tastes great with whey protein, and bananas. But other popular nutritious choices are instant oatmeal, dates and figs, melon, white potato, white rice, raisins, and sweet potato. In terms of numbers and timing, I recommend eating 40 to 50 grams of carbohydrates 30 minutes before you train to feel a noticeable improvement in your performance. Pre-workout dietary fat. Some people claim that by eating dietary fat before a workout, you can reduce carbohydrate utilization during exercise and thereby improve performance. Research has proven otherwise, however. A study conducted by researchers at Ball State University demonstrated that increased dietary fat intake 24 hours before exercising, cycling in this case, reduced time trial performance compared with a high carbohydrate diet. A study conducted by researchers from the Australian Institute of Sport demonstrated that even when your body becomes fat adapted and uses carbohydrates more sparingly while exercising, performance doesn't improve. Here's how researchers at Deakin University summarized their 2004 review of pre-workout fat intake literature. Thus, it would appear that while such a strategy can have a marked effect on exercise metabolism, i.e., reduced carbohydrate utilization, there is no beneficial effect on exercise performance. So, feel free to have dietary fat before you work out, but don't expect anything special to come out of it. That's it for pre-workout nutrition. 30 to 40 grams of protein and whey is best, and 40 to 50 grams of carbohydrate 30 minutes before training is all you need. The post-workout meal. The post-workout meal is part of the bodybuilding canon, so to speak. If you've been lifting for any period of time, you've heard this story. If you don't eat protein and or carbs after training, you'll either impair muscle growth or miss out on an opportunity to accelerate it. It's also often claimed that there is a post-workout anabolic window of time in which you must eat your food. If you miss this window, so the story goes, you either lose or miss out on additional gains. Well, the truth is, although these dogmas are overstated, there is some truth to them. You see, when you work out, you start a process whereby muscle proteins are broken down, technically known as proteolysis. This effect is mild while you're training, but it rapidly accelerates thereafter. If you're training in a fasted state, proteolysis is even greater, especially at 3 or more hours after training. Now, muscle breakdown isn't inherently bad, but when it exceeds the body's ability to synthesize new proteins, the net result is muscle loss. Conversely, when the body synthesizes more protein molecules than it loses, the net result is muscle growth. The goals of post-workout nutrition are minimizing post-workout muscle breakdown and maximizing protein synthesis. And similar to pre-workout nutrition, you achieve these effects by eating protein and carbohydrate after training. Post-workout protein. Eating protein after a workout stimulates protein synthesis, which halts muscle breakdown and initiates muscle growth. A study conducted by researchers at the University of Texas makes the importance of this clear. Researchers had subjects perform heavy leg resistance training, followed by the slow, over the course of several hours, ingestion of a placebo, a mixture of essential and non-essential amino acids, or a mixture of just essential amino acids. The result was the group that drank the placebo showed a negative muscle protein balance several hours after their workouts. That is, they were losing muscle. Whereas the groups that ingested the amino acid mixtures showed a positive balance, they were building muscle. We also know that post-workout protein stimulates more protein synthesis than protein eaten at rest. This was demonstrated by a study conducted by researchers at the Shriners-Burns Institute. They took 6 normal, untrained men and intravenously infused them with a balanced amino acid mixture, both at rest and after a leg workout. The post-workout infusion resulted in 30 to 100% more protein synthesis than the at-rest infusion. While these may seem like minor benefits, they add up over time. The more time your body spends building up proteins instead of breaking them down, the more muscle you gain as a result. Over the course of months or years, small protein synthetic advantages accrued every day can add up to several pounds of additional muscle mass. That isn't just theory either. Clinical research indicates that protein ingested within 1 to 2 hours of finishing a workout can indeed increase overall muscle growth over time. For example, a study conducted by researchers from Bispebjerg Hospital had 13 untrained elderly men follow a 12-week resistance training program. One group received an oral protein carbohydrate supplement immediately post-workout, while the other received the same supplement 2 hours following the exercise. The result, the post-workout ingestion group built more muscle than the 2 hours later ingestion group. A well-designed and well-executed study conducted by scientists at Victoria University is also worth reviewing. It was conducted with 23 recreational bodybuilders who followed an intense weightlifting program for 10 weeks and were divided into 2 groups. One, a group that ate a protein and carbohydrate meal immediately before and after training, and two, a group that ate the same meals in the morning and evening at least 5 hours outside the workouts. After 10 weeks, researchers found that the first group pre- and post-workout consumption built significantly more muscle than the second group, morning and evening consumption. So if post-workout protein is good, the obvious question is, how much should you eat? Well, earlier in the book, I mentioned a study commonly cited in connection with post-workout protein recommendations that demonstrated that 20 grams of post-workout protein stimulates maximum muscle protein synthesis in young men. That is, eating more than 20 grams of protein after working out did nothing more in terms of stimulating additional muscle growth. We can't assume that this 20-gram number applies to everyone, however, because protein metabolism is affected by several things. How much muscle you have. The more you have, the more amino acid your body needs to maintain your musculature, and the more places your body can store surpluses. How active you are. The more you move around, the more protein your body needs. How old you are. The older you get, the more protein your body needs to maintain its muscle. Your hormones. Elevated levels of growth hormone and insulin-like growth factor 1, IGF-1, stimulate muscle synthesis. If your body has high levels of these anabolic hormones, it will use protein better than someone who has low levels. On the other hand, elevated levels of cortisol reduce protein synthesis and accelerate the process whereby the body breaks down amino acids into glucose, gluconeogenesis, thereby reducing the amount available for tissue generation and repair. Some people have chronically elevated cortisol levels, and this impairs protein metabolism. So while 20 grams of protein might be enough to stimulate maximal muscle growth in certain people under certain conditions, it won't be enough for everyone. Some people will need more to reach the same level of synthesis, and others will be able to benefit from more protein. It will result in more protein synthesis. And this is why I recommend that you eat the familiar number of 30 to 40 grams of protein in your post-workout meal. The protein I use, which you can find in the bonus report, also contains additional leucine, which has been shown to further increase muscle protein synthesis over just whey protein alone. Post-workout carbohydrate. The most common reason we're told to eat carbs after training is to spike insulin levels, which is supposed to kick muscle growth into overdrive. This isn't entirely accurate because, as you now know, insulin doesn't tell your muscles to grow. It only has anti-catabolic properties. What is true, however, is that a post-workout insulin spike decreases the rate of protein breakdown that occurs after exercise. And as muscle growth is nothing more than protein synthesis rates exceeding protein breakdown rates, anything that increases the former and decreases the latter improves this equation in our favor. A good example of this at work is a study conducted by researchers from McMaster University that compared the effects of high and low carbohydrate dieting with subjects engaging in regular exercise. Researchers found that subjects following the low-carb diet had increased protein breakdown rates and reduced protein synthesis rates, resulting in less overall muscle growth. These insulin-dependent benefits level off around 15 to 30 microns per liter, or about 3 to 4 times the normal fasting insulin levels. Spiking insulin levels higher than this doesn't deliver more protein-sparing effects. And it turns out that you don't even need to eat carbs to reach such a level. You can do it with protein alone. One study showed that the insulin response to the ingestion of 45 grams of whey protein peaked at about 40 minutes. And these levels were sustained for about 2 hours. If you include carbs with your post-workout meal, however, insulin levels will rise faster and remain elevated longer. One study showed that the ingestion of a mixed meal containing 75 grams carbs, 37 grams protein, and 17 grams fat resulted in an elevation of insulin levels for more than 5 hours. At the 5-hour mark, when researchers stopped testing, insulin levels were still double the fasting level. So two reasons to include carbs in your post-workout meal are to quickly raise insulin levels and keep them elevated for longer periods of time. Another reason relates to glycogen. If you're weightlifting regularly, keeping your muscles as full of glycogen as you can is important. It improves performance, and research has shown that when muscle glycogen levels are low, exercise-induced muscle breakdown is accelerated. Anaerobic exercise like weightlifting and high-intensity interval cardio cause marked reductions in muscle glycogen stores, and when your body is in this post-workout glycogen-depleted state, its ability to use carbohydrates to replenish glycogen stores is greatly increased. In this state, your muscles can supercompensate with glycogen, meaning they can store more than they had before the depletion. This supercompensation likely won't affect your workout performance unless you engage in multiple bouts of intense exercise in the same day. So long as you eat enough carbs throughout the day, your body will eventually fill its glycogen stores back up. That said, the post-workout depleted state does create a nice carb sink, which you can use to enjoy a large number of carbs with little to no fat storage, as the body will not store carbohydrates as fat until glycogen stores are replenished. In terms of how much carbohydrate to eat,